Welcome to the Sourcing Hero podcast, produced by UNA, a group purchasing organization that empowers sourcing heroes, and Art of Procurement, the world's largest procurement podcast network. I'm your host, Kelly Barner. The goal of the Sourcing Hero podcast is to capture the epic stories of people who are rising up and beating the odds to create exceptional value within procurement, directly from those heroes themselves. Lawrence Kane is responsible for strategic sourcing functional excellence at a Fortune 50 company. As the best-selling author of 20 books, he co-wrote the Contract Professionals Playbook and contributed to both the outsourcing professional body of knowledge and strategic sourcing in the new economy. Hi, Lawrence. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Sourcing Hero podcast.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So, as I shared in my introduction, you are a very busy guy. Having written all of these books, clearly you have a little bit of passion and or enthusiasm for procurement. So can you just tell everybody a little bit about your current role and maybe where some of that passion that goes into your books comes from?
Sure. And by the way, it's actually 21 books now. So,
oh my gosh, 21 books. You must be exhausted. Well, that's great news. Congratulations on 21.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I probably don't sleep enough, but so I kind of fell into procurement. I started off actually in cost accounting, but I got better. It was one of those I thought it would be interesting to be in a field related to business. It was the first interesting job I found, and it turned out it was a horrible fit.
Oh,
but the good thing. Well, yeah, the good thing is though, I got a broad view of the company. I got to understand things like disclosure statements and cost accounting standards, federal acquisition regulations, auditing, things like that. I got a really broad view of kind of how the business worked and went, you know what? I don't like this accounting thing much, but I kind of like the business thing. And I kind of had this interesting path where I bounced around with a bunch of jobs other than that first one that were either created by me or created for me to meet some unmet business needs. So I got to do all kinds of cool special projects and kind of make stuff up along the way. And what I eventually discovered, long story short, is that I've got kind of a superpower, and the superpower isn't anything like, walking through walls or, flying or something really awesome. But what it is I'm one of those people who is gifted with the ability to see the big picture and it's in the consequential details simultaneously. And depending on what you read research wise, that's somewhere between about 3.8 and about 5.4% of the population. So not a lot of people can do that.
No, it's definitely a rare skill.
It is. And and the cool thing is, it took me a long time to figure out like why I ended up doing so well with these special assignments and whatnot. But what I found is actually in sourcing and procurement, there are more people disproportionate to the population that have that same kind of, brain chemistry. And so I stumbled into this field and I found a lot of peers at other companies that also stumbled into this field. Basically, because they're the person who, the execs call on to solve the hard problems. And in my case, I actually created our original IT infrastructure sourcing office. I created the skill codes that we have, the job roles that we have, and things like that. And it's something that's grown, enterprise-wide, but started in kind of a narrower spot. And it was all based on starting with a benchmark that turned into we need a strategy, that turned into go implement the strategy, which turned into multi-sourcing, which had never been done before at our scale, which turned into now we get a bunch of suppliers, how do we manage them and remediate value leakage and things like that. And so it's just sort of organically grown into this thing that back when I was in college didn't exist, right? There's a little bit about purchasing, a little bit about supply chain. There was no strategic sourcing. Procurement wasn't even really a thing yet. Not like it is today. And so, I've been able to help just sort of organically fall into this thing that makes the best use of my skills and also to sort of shape the direction of the industry. For example, you mentioned the Outsourcing Professional Body of Knowledge. That's mm-hmm. the International Association of Outsourcing Professionals sort of playbook that they do the testing from to get certifications. Well, I helped write 2 of the 10 chapters of that. So that's pretty cool, because that's now the industry standard for certification. And I've worked with SIG University Advisory Board and some other things like that to help shape what are those leading edge skills, what are those things that make us really, really awesome in this profession, and how do they actually work in real life, and make sure it's not just academic, but it's something, real. And I've gotten to play with a ton of that and actually help forge and shape it, which is pretty rare and pretty cool. So that's where the passion and stuff comes from. It's just, I stumbled into this thing, helped make it better, and then, get to go mentor and coach other folks and help just really make the industry what it is or what it can be.
Now, you mentioned the Outsourcing Professionals Body of Knowledge. Where in the 21 books did that one fall?
That actually doesn't count in that, because I was just a contributing author. So that's not one of them. The most like job related book that I've done is I'm the co-author of the Contract Professionals Playbook with Jeanette Nyden, who folks might recognize her name as part of, she was the lead author of Getting to We. She helped with Vested, which is a really transformational, kind of new playbook in our profession. And so that's my kind of work related one. That I've also done some leadership books and some other things that are generally that, but most of my books are not actually tied to our profession, because I work for a company where you have to go through a release of information process, which means they get to vet anything you write about that happens to be related to your job. And absolutely, that can take literally light years. Like, yeah. I'm only joking a little. I actually had one paper that I did for a conference that took 7.5 months to get approved for a 12-page paper.
So that's about one page per month, or a page and a half per month, something like that.
Yeah. So. Nobody said there'd be math. But, it's an opportunity and a challenge, right? Because I do a lot of presentations at conferences and things like that. But to write like a full book length on something and not get tied up in that whole vetting process, and that's kind of the same with a lot of large companies, right?
Sure.
But we're very highly regulated, very conservative company that I work for, and so I try to stay away from that. But things like with helping out with the OpBoc, well, I don't get paid for that. It's a volunteer thing. I'm part of a think tank and part of a training and certification committee, which is job related. So that didn't have to go through the process. So you see how, when you're the lead author and you're getting royalties, it's handled differently than if you were just a contributor, so to speak, right? So that's kind of how I've managed to actually do content without getting myself in trouble.
Absolutely. And it's actually interesting, because as I think about what you characterized as your superpower, sort of this ability to think high and think low in parallel, I can see where that would come into play in the content creation process too, right? Because you want there to be sort of an overarching narrative or a thesis and support, depending on what kind of book it is. Mm-hmm. But you also want to make sure that all of the lower level detail is just as of high quality and cohesive as sort of the high level overlook. Do you enjoy going through the publishing process, or for you, is it more just about the content creation and the thinking about the message that you want to share versus sort of working through like the editorial and the feedback and the restructuring or the co-author process?
Well, it's a little of both. I most of the things I've written, I'm actually a co-author of. I do very few just myself. And part of it is I work really well in teams, and I find that my creativity feeds off other people's, and you get 1 + 1 = 27, because it's it's much more better, which is beauteous grammar. Part of the reason I'm saying it like that is one of the things that happens in the editing process is you can get an editor who understands you know, all the rules and stuff, but not how to tell a good story. Or yes, you can get an editor that understands, you know, the full end to end. And so I break grammar rules all the time. That's also why I'm a best-selling author, right? So, you know, if I'm writing, like, if you go back to the Contract Professionals Playbook, that's pretty dry. It was co-written with a lawyer. It's designed to be very practical, useful, you know, actual stuff you're going to go and take from, you know, the higher level, here's the philosophy and the process or the strategy, drive down it. Now here's tactically what you need to do step by step to actually implement it. And so you have a different writing style there than, say, we did a self-help book called Dude, the World's Gonna Punch You in the Face. Here's how to make it hurt less. As you can tell, a little different, right?
Yes.
That one, the cover picture is literally a boxing glove with the image of the world on it, punching a guy in the face, who happened to be my co-author's son. And we did this take probably, I don't know, it's probably 15 different takes that we took to get the picture exactly right. So it really looks like he's actually getting hit. And then did some, you know, Photoshop things to make it even more believable. And the whole point of that book was we spent more time doing research into the audience and trying to figure out how it would work and how it would resonate, including the cover art and the back cover text and all that, than we actually did writing it, because it was designed for parents to leave basically lying around, you know, on the back of the toilet seat or on the countertop or whatever. And kids would go, and we actually product tested this. They go, they pick it up, they'd look at the cover and they set it down. Come back again, pick it up, look at the cover, kind of flip over to the back, set it down. Third time, thumb through, pick a couple random pages, and then they disappear with the book and show up again a month later as a different person. And it was very consistent to the target demographic of that's how we made it work, because you don't want your, you know, if you're a teenage boy, you don't want your parents telling you that you need to go do X, Y, or Z, right?
No.
But you need somebody to help you figure out what that path needs to be. And so, you know, that one, the power of that book was all in the way it was designed specific fit to audience, as opposed to the Contract Professionals Playbook, which is designed for a completely different audience and trying to upskill people in our industry, right? And you know, contract terms are quite different than, you know, there it was stories and stuff, right? So it very, very different. And so working with an editor and a publisher and all that, you have to be with people who can handle that.
Yes.
Like sometimes you want to break all the rules and sometimes you got to follow all the rules. Yeah. And so there's a very long way of saying that eventually I got so tired of working with publishers that I actually co-founded a publishing company. So now I hire all the talent and I have to worry about that stuff. That's the difference, right? Of working as somebody in the procurement industry versus somebody who's, you know, a creative talent, right? I am not an artist. I'm a craftsman. I can do all kinds of really awesome stuff, but I don't treat it as, you know, it's my life and it's art. I treat it as I'm doing this so I can provide something of value to that people want to buy and I can make money on it.
Well, and I did not anticipate that this would be the transition, but I think the quote comes down perfectly. Speaking of, dude, the world is going to punch you in the face. Boy, have we been through a year and a half, right?
Yes.
You were like ahead of your time. That was a prophetic time. I can almost feel the boxing glove, right? Like right in my face. And procurement has been in the spotlight, but that attention hasn't all necessarily been positive and it hasn't been free. And I think the thing that's interesting is that we've been affected collectively, both as a professional community and also as teams within companies, but it's also affected sort of the individual level market for talent.
Oh, yeah.
What have you observed about procurement talent over the last year and a half, 2 years? And what kinds of investments do you think companies are making as a result of the talent needs that exist right now?
So let me back that up just a touch before I answer your direct question and talk about pre-pandemic, post-pandemic, right? Before the pandemic, if you went on LinkedIn, you saw a ton of jobs for like purchasing manager still, right? That's 1960s nomenclature for what we do.
Typewritten.
And very, very tactical. Actually, it might have been 1940s, but you get the point, right? It's very tactical, procure to pay, push paper through, get her done. That's all stuff we can automate, right? That's all stuff that you don't really need a professional for. You need really good software and a couple of people to keep it running, right? As you go up that value chain, you start seeing purchasing turning into procurement, turning into strategic sourcing, turning into global business services, or indirect supply chain. They call it different things in different companies. But the point is that during the pandemic, folks realized that, you know, supply chains actually don't run themselves. They need really smart people and they need really good technology. And, you know, things like one of my favorite examples, Trader Joe's during the pandemic in the early time frame never ran out of toilet paper, whereas every other seller out there did. And the reason was because the toilet paper manufacturers went from building, you know, product that was partly commercial and partly for home use to basically having to rotate all for home use. So there wasn't enough of it. Well, a buyer who I have no idea who, he or she is, somebody at Trader Joe's went and reached out to one of the hotel chains and said, "Hey, you got a bunch of toilet paper. You don't get any clients. We got a lot of clients. We don't have any toilet paper. Can we make a deal?" You can't do that with purchasing software.
No, you can't. Right?
You have to have a smart, strategic person to go figure out, hey, the usual sources are drying up. How can I be creative? And, you know, if we get software that can do that, we're all out of business, right? Because AIs run the world and we don't need humans, which could be good or bad, or, you know, it could be the Terminator, or it could be, you know, we're all hanging out on a beach and, sipping margaritas all day or whatever. But the point is that, you know, when you see stories like that and you see how the need for the supply chain professional, whatever, you know, version you want to call it, is more and more understood by companies, you start to also see CPOs who are now starting to report to the CEO instead of the CPO goes to the CFO, goes to the COO, right, goes to the CEO or whatever, that whole seat at the table at the top thing. And so I think what's happened is not only have we discovered that our profession is really important, but companies are starting to realize that its value is not just cost savings, right? It's about speed to market. It's about innovation. It's about value creation. It's about creating new markets. It's about, you know, all kinds of really important stuff that we all know, but maybe our stakeholders didn't. Well, now they do, which means that as things open back up, the talent market is not only there's a massive need for more folks, but there's a massive need for folks with a much higher skill set. I mean, that's actually why we wrote the book, The Contract Professionals Playbook, was to try to get folks who have maybe a degree and a little bit of experience to be able to move up that value chain and to be able to actually do some of this higher end stuff. And so Jeanette and I not only made the book, we made a e-learning program and such like that. And really trying to help. Same thing with, you know, IOP certification process or SIG or any of the, you know, ISM, any of these folks, right? There's a lot of sources out there to try to help people upskill and move to that next level. And then I'm seeing a lot more need in the industry to hire those folks who are at the higher level. And there's still some low end stuff out there. And I mean, low end in terms of, you know, the, you know, kind of procurement operations, procure to pay, sort of more paper pushy stuff, as opposed to the strategic, you know, move the business stuff, because it's not all automated yet by any means. And there are companies who still haven't really figured out the role that strategic procurement can play in terms of shaping their business. But I'm seeing more and more of that. And if you start looking at job titles and how they change on LinkedIn or other, you know, sites like that, you start to see more strategic titles and more strategic descriptions. And I think that's really exciting for us.
And what that brings to mind, though, is sort of like a good news, bad news situation, where on the one hand, the roles are becoming higher up the value chain. As you said, they're also becoming more interesting, more visible, more important to the overall health of the company. But that creates sort of an interesting challenge for HR teams and hiring managers, because you're not necessarily looking for a person that fits in the cookie cutter shape that you happen to be holding. You're looking for someone with a rather unique combination of soft skills and creativity and problem solving capacity and all of that. What do you think might be some of the trends that are either starting now among leading companies or maybe up and coming as companies realize they can't look to the same sources of talent? How is our hiring and recruiting process going to have to change to accommodate this type of skill level?
Oh, you are so right about that. And in fact, that's one of the things, you know, people throw the term AI around a lot, which really is more, you know, machine learning. It's not like, you know, cognitive AI anyway.
Yeah.
But that's one of the worst things that HR has ever done is the software that vets resumes when they come in and that scrapes job descriptions and stuff off of, you know, LinkedIn or whatever. Because what happens is you're basically pushing to keyword matching and you lose a lot of that stuff. And so I see a big increase in the need for recruiters who really understand our field and can help, you know, find that talent. I see a big need for folks to be broader in the job description because, for example, most of what my team does is we buy IT. And so we mean people who are not just procurement savvy and business literate, but people who actually really understand at a fairly deep level IT. So we knew things like write a statement of work, you know, SLAs, negotiate, you know, the technical architecture and things like that, right? So it's not just a kind of you know, business and legal sort of aspects of it, but it's a lot of the technical things too. And so if you write a job description that's really, you know, old school procurement focused, for lack of a better term, you're not going to get people who can actually do the job. And so I'm seeing, you know, more need for those specialty recruiters. I'm seeing more need for a careful job analysis that drives that job description that then goes out and looks for the right talent and not just taking a boilerplate job description. I'm seeing a lot of more need for better interviewing techniques. You know, behavioral interviewing is kind of my favorite approach, but not just asking the general questions, but actually trying to get into what experience have you had in doing these out of the box things that we need and trying to have, you know, how would you solve this problem kinds of conversations. And I don't mean the stuff, the scam that sometimes people do, which is trying to get free consulting. I mean, understand how people think and how they do problem solving and figure out what are the aspects of the job that I can teach and what are the aspects of the job that somebody has to bring in. And so, for example, we've licensed IOP's Outsourcing Masterclass and Governance Workshop and have some folks to teach that. I'm a master certified instructor and we have some other instructors inside of our company. And so that basic knowledge, which is, you know, 4 full days of training and then some follow-on stuff we've done internally, that you know, has actually gotten talent management awards from industry. All that training is already there, right? I don't need somebody who already has that. It's great if they do, but they don't have to have it. There are certain, you know, soft skills and certain hard skills though, that I can't train in a short enough period of time. I don't want somebody who's going to be productive 18 months from now. I need somebody who's going to be productive, right, you know, at the most, maybe 3 months from now, right? Because it does take time to get, you know, onboarded and understand how one company does things versus another and all that sort of stuff. So I'm seeing more of a need for us to think a little bit broader in terms of making sure we're vetting the talent, really looking at the global marketplace. There's great talent, you know, everywhere, right? We've proven another thing in the pandemic, and that is you can remotely work from almost anywhere.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, you know, unless you've got specific job-related restrictions like, you know, ITAR error laws or mm-hmm. you know, access to you know, companies' critical technical information, and you know, maybe there's certain restrictions that go with that, or other, you know, things that say, I'm sorry, we can't use somebody from this particular geography or that don't fit into this, you know, like if it's ITAR error requires a U.S. person, which is a legal definition, it's a export control laws in the U.S. They're similar in, you know, UK and Australia and other countries, right? But the point is, unless you're restricted because of something like that, then start to think about, well, okay, can we do a follow the sun? Does everybody have to be in the same time zone? Does everybody have to be, near the same time zone? Where are our customers? Where are our suppliers? How do we organize and structure this thing so we can get best talent? And then how do we actually recruit the people who can do the best work and have those sort of future skills, and not so much look at, you know, I want 2,700 years of, you know, procure to pay, and I want, you know, all this tactical stuff that's listed out that you don't get the right keyword matching, as opposed to positioning for future, right? I want to see a track record of experience, but I don't want it to be narrow and myopic. And that's something that, again, if you do a boilerplate, job description, you're probably going to get the wrong people.
Right. Well, and it's certainly not a simple or easy task to get the right people, but it's absolutely critical to do that sort of, again, going back to your superpower, to find the right people on an individual level, but at the same time, create the right group of people that will mesh and achieve what the company needs them to create and work well and happily together. And so it's interesting that that came up so early on in the conversation. And then, of course, I can't let you go without asking you specifically, in the context of being a guest on the Sourcing Hero podcast, you've talked about what you think your superpower is. If we speak more generally, what does the idea of someone being a sourcing hero mean to you?
Great question. Part of it is, it almost goes back to our job description conversation, right? I want people who can really look at the what the company does and understand an unmet business need and how to fill it best, right? What you don't want is somebody who, you know, I'll use the example of pounding nails with a drill, right? Drills are designed to make holes. They're good at it. Can they pound nails? Sure, but it's pretty hard on the drill. It's sooner or later you're going to break it. So, you know, I want to be able, you know, if I'm looking to pound nails, I want to solve that problem. If I'm looking to drill holes, I want to solve that problem. But sometimes when our stakeholders ask us, hey, I want you to go and drill a bunch of holes, you go, I don't think you're really asking the right question. Let's think of this a different way. And so, you know, it's when you get to the conversations around what does success look like for this project? Is it cost savings? Is it innovation? Is it speed to market? Is it, you know, whatever, right? And so I want people who can actually go and build rapport and credibility with executives and make sure that our constituents are actually asking the right questions so that we can move the bar for the company. We can get very, very myopic because, you know, VP XYZ says, hey, I need to save 27% in this thing. And you go, you know, I've done some market analysis. I've looked at this category. You're probably not going to save more than maybe 10 or 12% without putting the suppliers into a spot where they're tempted to lawyer up, or you're going to have other challenges out there. You might suffer in quality, whatever it happens to be. But have you thought about maybe this different approach? So we're not buying the same thing and trying to save a couple of bucks. Maybe we're buying something different that's actually going to solve the problem in a better way. Those are the people that I want, right? So because a lot of times you kind of salute the org chart, right? And you go off and do whatever you're told to go do. I don't want people who are totally rogue, but I do want people who are willing to come back and go, have you considered, and make sure we have the right conversation? Because I can't think of how many times I've been asked a question. If I just blindly gone and done it, it would have been the wrong answer, right? But I have a very respectful conversation that says, help me understand more about the problem we're trying to solve here, and make sure that we're actually going off and doing the right thing. Because the last thing you want to do is spend, you know, 6 months or a year or 18 months or whatever it is doing this big complex procurement. By the time you get to the end, the folks who are supposed to sign the deal come back and go, what are you doing?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, you know, and it's interesting because as you and I record this conversation, it's late July, and ironically, only a couple of hours ago, I was speaking with Anthony Kulervi and Chris Lance, both from Una, and we were talking about the fact that people in sales, sometimes people in marketing, they become conditioned over time to not only handle objections when they're raised, but be prepared to anticipate those objections and so handle them better. And I don't think that that's one of the things that we do a great job as procurement people helping our teams learn to do. It's sort of like a soft skill that has a lot of application within procurement, but that we don't think of it within the narrow confines. And we don't tend to emphasize its importance or give people the opportunity to practice it. You know, so the examples that you gave about trying to encourage your team to say, well, have you thought about or have you considered? Those are both very adept ways of either responding to a savings target that you know you're never going to hit, or handling a situation where maybe the business thinks they want to do one thing and you can see that the opportunity is different and you have to constructively reframe it and help. Not that you're going to tell them what to do, but orient them towards a broader range of options. Is that type of a skill, that objection handling or objection preparation, is that something that you see people coming in with, if you can tell how they think? Or is that something that you've seen more people either be coached or learn to how to handle on the job?
I think it's a little of both. And part of the reason for that is because all the stakeholders are different, right? There are some stakeholders who, if you don't convince them it was their own idea in the first place, are never going to listen to you. Whereas others, you know, facts and data is going to drive the decision. And so, you know, you certainly want people who are going to question and who are going to look a little broadly, but who are not going to be argumentative and have that, you know, kind of, you know, people skills, mindfulness, and a, you know, sort of, you know, ability to understand the audience and play to the audience. You know, some folks call that emotional intelligence, right? Yeah. But really a lot of it's teaching people kind of the business, right? And so if you get somebody with the right mindset and they really understand the business correctly, then we're starting to drive, you know, what is it that our business says? Again, going back to where I work, right? I work in IT buying for a company that doesn't sell IT for the most part, mm-hmm. maybe a little bit in some of the products, but it's really not like a major thing that we do. And it's not a source of revenue. So it's an indirect, you know, back office function that enables the enterprise. Well, if I don't understand what the enterprise actually does and how the enterprise makes money, then how do I know I've got a good IT contract to support that, right? I could start getting really deep and centric into having the best or whatever, you know, IT solution, which may or may not be appropriate to what the actual business need is. And so part of that is really just drawing that thread from the top of here's what the organization does at the top level down to my piece of the organization and how we support or enable that. And how do we make decisions? And really, you know, looking at things like, you know, using tools like a stakeholder matrix to understand how do I influence people to do the right things and some tactical stuff, right? So you start with big strategy, drive it into tactics. You build kind of the some of the skills that are necessary to handle those particular folks, and you provide the insight that's necessary. One of the fastest ways to get somebody up to speed in a company like where I work, where decisions are really made based on who you know, it's a relationship company, is to help everybody understand how decisions are actually made. This person's at the top of your chart, but these other three people influence that person and what they're going to do. So what you really need to do is go to this person and then these couple people and then this other person over there, and together you can come up and get the decision maker to decide something. If you just go to the decision maker, they're not going to decide anything because they're going to want to check with their people to make them feel comfortable and smart or whatever, right? I'm making that up, but you get the point.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Lawrence, this has been absolutely fascinating. And I know there are a lot of people that are either searching for new team members or people that are searching for open positions that are going to certainly take all of your advice to heart and maybe approach their next talent-related conversation differently. If people are listening in today and they are interested in connecting with you, learning more about your books, seeing your point of view on social media, what do you typically recommend is the best way to get in touch with you?
Well, probably the easiest thing is just find me on LinkedIn. It's Lawrence A. Kane, Kane with a K. I'm also, if you want to go on Amazon, you can search for me that way too and find my author page. And there's ways to contact me through that as well. But probably the easiest thing is LinkedIn, just because it's all in one spot. And then you can, you know, find ways to contact me directly, or you can see all of my books are on there and click through those, or, you know, whatever's good. I pretty much default to, if somebody sends me a connection request, I will accept it. And then if they immediately start selling me stuff, I will make their life miserable. So, you know, just a warning.
Hey, fair enough. We consider ourselves warned. Well, Lawrence, thank you again so much. Thank you everyone for listening in. If you are planning to follow Lawrence or check him out on Amazon and check his books, do it quickly, or he's going to be at number 22 before you have a chance to experience the first 21. But thank you so much for sharing your point of view today and your time and for giving everybody something really interesting to think about.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being here. And also, if anybody's listening who's on Procurement Foundry, I'm part of that as well. So you can connect with me through that as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Sourcing Hero podcast. Join us again next time for more true stories of sourcing and business heroism performed by your colleagues and peers. Look for the Sourcing Hero wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to subscribe. Finally, don't forget, sourcing heroism is taking place all around us every day. Keep your eyes open and you're bound to see it. Until next time, I'm your host, Kelly Barner. Stay well, and always remember that you can be a hero too.